Good morning. I'm Dick Beeman. I'll be your convener today. I'd like to welcome all of you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. And I'd like to thank my special welcoming committee for helping me to welcome you. We extend a special welcome to visitors, and we encourage you to join us in a free and open search for truth and understanding and meaning, unfettered by dogma or doctrine, but guided by our seven principles, which you can find in the back of your order of service. We invite you to spend an hour with us or a lifetime. Our little community is composed of theists, non-theists, Christians, pagans, skeptics, searchers, and seekers of all flavors. Most of us are refugees or immigrants from other faith traditions. We have open borders. We have no immigration quotas. You don't need a visa. There are no residency requirements. Many paths and many doors lead to our Unitarian Universalist village. There are many gates to the city. Please look at the lyrics in your order of service to find the locations of the entrances. Three gates to the north and three to the south. There's three in the east and three in the west. There's 12 gates to the city. Hallelujah. Oh, 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 what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city. 12 gates to the city. Hallelujah. Well, there are so many ways to get to the city. So many ways to get to the city. There are so many ways to get to the city. 12 gates to the city. Hallelujah. Oh, 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 what a beautiful city. You can walk right in, you'll be welcome in the city. You can walk right in, you'll be welcome in the city. You can walk right in, you'll be welcome in the city. 12 gates to the city. Hallelujah. Oh, 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 what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city. 12 gates to the city, hallelujah. And you can come from the east to the middle of the city. You can come from the west to the middle of the city. We will meet all together in the middle of the city. 12 gates to the city, hallelujah. Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, hallelujah. Welcome. William, would you light the chalice? Thank you. The chalice today reminds us to see through the outer trappings of everything around us and to perceive the essences and the elemental truths that underlie them. Please refer to your order of service for announcements, and I was not handed any other announcements, so let's go right on to the joys and concerns.
Testing, test.
Okay. The Campbells have a baby girl. We do not know the name yet, but was born this week.
As many of you know, my lovely wife Kelly has her own business now, the Gluten Free Valkyrie and That Jam I Am. We have had our third continuous successful week at the Junction City Farmers Market. And today we are bringing in some homemade banana muffins and some homemade mulberry jam that we actually picked the mulberries last week with Dick and his wife down here at the trees.
Hi, Alex Stenson. So this is kind of both a joy and a concern. This will be the last Sunday that I can attend because of a conference schedule and whatnot before we move to Vermont. So thank you.
Larry Weaver. Wanted to share a sadness in our family. We got very bad news on Friday that my wife's sister, Michelle, married to Woods. They were on their way from Chicago to Detroit to see an exhibit at the Detroit Art Museum. And a little bit west of Kalamazoo, they were stopped in a long line of traffic. They were the last car, and a semi plowed into them, killing Woods. And Michelle is in the hospital, but expected to recover. However, this, of course, means some family support is going to be required. So if you don't see me for a few weeks, these are the kinds of things that are going on. Fortunately, the Thompson, my wife's family, is a large family with a lot of possibilities for support. But this does bring home to me the importance of living each moment and recognizing what's important in your life. And one of the institutions that's important in my life, so I want to get it out there for the public before I get rear-ended on a road, is that this Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is an institution that has enriched my life for more than 40 years. And I appreciate and thank all of you for keeping this place alive, vibrant, and a home for people like me. Thank you.
Tom Manny, and I have two announcements. Actually, make the first one, and which is to welcome our daughter Natalia, who was probably a member of this fellowship 40 years ago as well. And the second announcement, I think I'll let her make.
Well, I just became a great grandmother last Saturday night. So that makes him a great-great-grandfather, and my mom is a great-great-grandmother. My granddaughter, Kiara, gave birth to a little girl named Luna Cortana at about 10:20 on the 4th of July, so she came in with some fireworks. And they're up in Lawrence, which is where I live on my small farm.
I think some of you have met my daughter Madeline and her husband Peter. Well, his grandmother in Rhode Island passed away early last week, and she had been suffering from Alzheimer's and was in a nursing home for, I think it was like 5 years. So it's kind of a relief at the same time, hard for everybody, but anyway.
Iris, did you have
one?
Okay, last word.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to say that Destiny and William's family just got back from Missouri, and I'm really happy they're back.
Thank you for those. We are mindful that there are joys and concerns that are unspoken. I want to give you a little reflection on abstract art. And later, Lindsay can correct all my misunderstandings of the topic. Imagine stars, moons, and planets gleaming in the night sky. Now imagine white dots and circles of varying sizes arranged randomly or irregularly on a black square canvas. Or maybe they're arranged in an orderly or systematic way. One viewer immediately thinks of the night sky. Another viewer sees only a pleasing design at first and then thinks, oh, it's the night sky. A third viewer sees only a pleasing design. Abstract art strives to depict the pure mood or feeling associated with an object while dispensing with the object itself. It goes beneath the skin of nature and touches its essence. A round spot in a painting can be more significant than an entire human figure, said the abstract artist Kandinsky. The impact of the acute angle of a triangle touching a circle, he said, produces an effect no less powerful than the finger of God touching the finger of Adam in Michelangelo's creation on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And now Lindsay will present the children's story.
So welcome. It's nice to see all these shining faces. I'm going to read the story Art Dog. Does anybody ever seen this book, Art Dog, before? Ruby, have you seen it? Of course. Yeah, since it's your book. Or maybe it was Iris's book. Anyway, it does have pictures this time. Last week, my story did not have pictures. I'll try to show the pictures as I read. Arthur Dog was a guard at the Dogopolis Museum of Art. He liked his job. He liked guarding the paintings by Vincent Van Dog and Pablo Poodle, but Leonardo da Vinci was Arthur's favorite painter. Or was it Henri Matisse? Arthur couldn't decide. At night, Arthur came home to his little apartment on West 17th Street, made himself dinner, and read until it was time for bed. Arthur led a quiet life. He seldom went out, except on nights when the moon was full. On those nights, Arthur's eyes grew bright, and his fur seemed to glisten. He would take out a box he kept in his closet. Put on a hat and a mask, and tiptoed down the back stairs into the streets of Dogopolis. He crept down the alley, and when he was sure no one was around, he unlocked the box and took out... What do you think he was taking out? Paint? What? Art supplies, exactly. He painted a splash of lightning, a splash of sunshine, and dozens of glowing lights in the night. He painted monsters 10 feet tall, fish with tails the size of houses, frogs ready to hop over skyscrapers. It's probably good if I show everybody the pictures. When he was finished, he crept home, a dog alone, wondering if anyone ever noticed his paintings. No one saw him paint or sign his paintings with a splat of his tail. And the name Art Dog, no one knew who Art Dog really was until one night at the museum. Crash! A window was broken. A door was busted. Bring! The alarm went off, and footsteps clattered down the alley behind the museum. What do you think happened? Somebody broke into the museum. The police searched the scene of the crime. The director of the museum was not far behind. Yikes! The Mona Woofa's gone, cried the museum director. Look what they left instead, a Leonardo da Vinci. Is this art? Looks like Mona Lulu to me, said the chief of police. The paint's still wet, said the museum director. So obviously that painting did not look the same as the ones before. Find me the culprit, barked the chief of police. They nabbed the first dog they found in the alley. His eyes had a certain glow to them, and his fur seemed to glisten in the moonlight. He also had a paintbrush in his paw. Book him, said the chief of police, and they threw him in jail. But this was Art Dog. It was not the culprits, right? When no one was looking, he pulled out a brush and the tube of paint that he'd painted, and he painted a ladder. He climbed up the ladder, and where there were bars, he painted a window and jumped out. So he escaped, correct? Back onto the streets of Dogopolis. Then he put his nose in the air. What was he smelling? Suddenly, he took out his brush and his paints. Zip, splash, swoosh. He painted himself a brush mobile with his name on the side. He whizzed over the Acme paint factory to fill up his tank. Then off he roared into the night, over highways and bridges, through the park and past the ballet, leaving a trail of paint behind him as he went. He slammed on the brakes in front of the deserted warehouse. He sniffed, he tiptoed, he looked inside. Three nasty-looking mutts were getting ready to ship something to a distant port. He took a closer look. It was the Mona. Yikes. The mutts turned around. Hey, what are you doing here? Said the biggest mutt. Gosh, I must have made a wrong turn, said Art Dog. You can say all that night, said the mutts. It looked like big trouble for Art Dog. There was really only one thing left to do. Paint. So what is he doing? Huh? He's painting, but he's also apprehending the culprits, correct? With his paint. What a masterpiece. Wow, said the chief of police. So what Art Dog did is he painted all the culprits into a painting so they were caught. How did you know where the Mona was? Art Dog wiggled his nose. I can smell art a mile away. The director of the museum said, I don't know how to thank you. Mr. Art Dog, said Art Dog, pointing to his brushmobile. Art dog, I like the way you paint. How about a show at the museum? Sure thing, said Art Dog, as he sped away in his brushmobile. Soon it was the night for Art Dog's show at Dogopolis Museum of Art. Everyone stood around and sipped root beer as they waited to meet Art Dog and see his paintings. But where was he? Where were his paintings? And for that matter, wondered the museum director, where's Arthur? He should be on the job tonight. Suddenly, there was a sound. Everyone rushed outside just in time to see Art Dog high in the sky, finishing his masterpiece, City Rhapsody. Everyone was amazed and speechless. Then suddenly he was gone. Who was Art Dog? Who was this painter in a brushmobile, catcher of crooks, bringer of light to the Dogopolis night? And no one knows, because Arthur kept it a secret. Did you like that?
Today is Helping Hand Sunday, and today we have representatives from the Guardian Angel, Vern Hendricks and Blake Kaus, and I want to remind you that all of the offerings that are not specifically designated for the Unitarian Fellowship go to the beneficiary today. So Vern and Blake, come right up.
Thank you very much for having us here today. Dixie, thanks for arranging it. I'm Blake Kaus, president of the Guardian Angels Fund. Brief history. We were formed 2 years ago. We're part of the Greater Manhattan Community Foundation, which Vern Hendricks is president of the Manhattan Greater Community Foundation here as well. We were formed 2 years ago to mirror, many of you have heard about, the Fairy Godmothers Fund, which is women helping women for things outside of social services. And Guardian Angels is the same thing for men, men helping men, to help them with things outside of social services that aren't covered. We actually have a grant application process for those in need. We give away, help those in need up to $600 per application per year for an individual. There's a various clearinghouses of entities that help provide us with the applicants, such as Salvation Army, Manhattan Emergency Shelter, Shepherd's Crossing, things of that nature, to help clearhouse for those individuals in need. I'll have Vern speak to you about briefly about some of the stories with those, but those who want, who are interested in becoming members, you can become a member for $100 a year, annual contribution. A founder member, you can do a one-time gift of $500 and $100 thereafter, but any participation is always greatly encouraged and certainly appreciated very much. I'll have Vern speak to a couple things about the foundation and some of the stories we help individuals with.
Thanks, Blake. First, it's obvious that through the love that you all extend for each other and those that aren't here, that this is a very caring and helping community of individuals. So we thank you for that, and God bless you for that. The Guardian Angels have basically been in existence for a couple years to help men who need that one extra step to keep them out of some dependency of some so forth. We have tended to provide transportation like bicycles just so that they could get to work, or in some cases where they've just got a job to kind of keep them moving forward. It seems like for the men that we have purchased a large number of beds. You know, they may have gotten themselves out of the emergency shelter, or they may have gotten a job, and they may have got a place to stay, but they don't really have the comfort of home in order to prepare themselves for their work the next day. And so a couple of examples of things that the support that individuals that support the guardian angels have done. And we'll be around later on if you'd want a little more extensive stories. We don't want to take too long in services today, but here again, we're very appreciative of the opportunity of the support that you've given us in the past and to visit with you today. And these men are in a situation in life that I think epitomizes what you as a group of individuals care for most, and that's to help them towards the benefits of their life as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Renee. Sorry, I jumped the gun in passing out the offertory bowls, and I heard that they didn't make it around. Are there any rows that didn't see the offertory bowls? Maybe we should pass them around again and double our take. All right, today, one of our own members, Lindsay Smith, is going to present the program, a program on geometric abstraction in art. Lindsay is, as I say, is a UUFM member. He's a master of art. He's an artist, a painter, and a printmaker. And for almost the last 20 years, he has been the designer of exhibitions at the Beach Museum of Art at Kansas State University. And today he is going to help us explore the world of geometric abstraction and art illustrated with examples from his own work. So, Lindsay, come on up. And you're going to be over there. Lindsay, maybe somebody could help me lift this down.
Thanks, Dick. I appreciate that. Before we get into the slides, I was here last week and I heard Terry Schmitz talk, and she's been a good friend for a number of years. And I like that format, just sitting up here, maybe fairly informally, you know, not having to turn around and look at the slides above us. Hopefully we'll have enough time for questions. I think we're pretty good on time at this point. hopefully I won't rattle on too long. 20 minutes is about my limit anyway. But before we get into the artwork, I just want to talk about the title of the exhibition, In Defense of Geometry. And that comes from an exhibition I had at Barton County Community College. I think that was 1999. And there were 34 paintings within that exhibition, starting from about 1982 until 1999. And since 1982, my serious work has been an exploration of geometric abstraction, non-objective or relief painting, as critics had labeled it, or also the term hard-edged painting has been used. So non-objective art defines a type of abstraction that is usually, but not always, geometric. So this is going to be kind of a brief history lesson for a few minutes before I start talking about my own work, just to put everything in context of the 20th century or 21st century as we are now. Oops, sorry. I need to go forward. This is Marsden Hartley, American modernist. And I want to kind of talk about, like I said, pretty much 20th century, basically from this point about World War I on. And he did a whole series of paintings around World War I. Military symbolism. So as you can tell, he's kind of abstracting kind of all those images. Wassily Kandinsky from about 1923. And it was nice that Dick had a quote from Kandinsky. I mean, that he wrote a book concerning the spiritual and art that was a real important treatise for painters, artists of the 20th century, where he explained his own philosophy. I'm not a person to look up quotes and say that kind of stuff myself, but I appreciate Dick talking about that because it, you know, puts it in other artists' words, you know, about what they're thinking. So Wassily Kandinsky was a Russian constructivist painter, and he was a pioneer of non-objective art in the first half of the 20th century. Kandinsky's own theory on painting concerning the spiritual and art was written in 1912. So all these artists that I'm talking about were people I studied when I came to school in 1980 up at Kansas State. Of course, you take all the survey classes. You take all the beginning drawing classes, painting classes, that type of thing. So it wasn't until about 1982 when I started doing serious, what I consider serious work, serious painting, printmaking. I was doing printmaking with Jim Muntz at the time. And I'll talk about more about that later. George O'Keeffe. She was an American modernist. This is the Radiator Building painted in 1927. So American modernists, urban painters, I guess, is the best way to talk about it. So they're abstracting the cities or the cityscape. Non-objective art may attempt to visualize the spiritual and even be seen as carrying a moral dimension, standing for virtues like purity and simplicity. So we're going to skip forward to the 1940s. This is a P.A. Mondrian from, this is around 1940. You have much later Jasper Johns, flag painting 1958. And these are not totally chronological, but I'm just trying to put it in context of imagery that I was looking at, and that hopefully you'll see those influences in my work. Ad Reinhardt, and he wrote a book book, a real famous book called Art is Art, and very deep thinker. Again, I could not even comprehend half of what he was talking about myself but reading the book. But this is a book you would study. You would be required to read, you know, in art history classes. And this is from 1962. So this is part of his black paintings, which he's best known for. It doesn't translate on the screen very well, but it is a monochrome painting. But there's a lot of different tones of black within that, black and blue. So Reinhardt was influential in movements of conceptual art, minimalism, and monochrome painting. And his book, Art as Art, was published in, I actually don't have the date of that, actually. I think it was in the 1960s. In the 1960s, a group of American artists, including Sol LeWitt, Yves Klein, Donald Judd, and others, embraced the philosophy of non-objective art by creating highly simplified geometric forms out of industrial materials. They elevated these to an aesthetic level. Their work became known as minimal art. Here's an installation of Donald Judd's work that is now in Marfa, Texas. These would have been done in the 1960s. We're going to move. It's a similar time frame, but a different artist, Ellsworth Kelly. His stuff, he was known as a hard edge painter, but his stuff kind of embraces all kinds of minimalist art. Shaped canvases, works on paper. He's still alive and working today. So Mondrian, Judd, Kelly, Reinhardt have all been grouped with minimal art of some type. Not that they're always defined by that, but that's part of their history. So as I said, my studies began in earnest in 1980 at Kansas State University, where I received my BFA in 1984. And during my studies, I was looking at all the artists and art movements mentioned previously. And my media of interest was painting, drawing, and printmaking. So we moved to the time at K-State, and I'm going to show some of my professors. Jim Muntz, many of you probably know Jim. Quite the master printmaker, drawer. So he was very, very influential, just from a drawing perspective and composition. I did quite a number of prints, mostly lithography, in his classes. I'll show one after a while. I wish I had his talent, because it's just incredible how he can work. So one thing that I will mention, that even though Dick said I did prints, I mean, this was the only time I did printmaking in any way that had any value, early 1980s. It's a fine art that takes a lot of time and a lot of skill, and I didn't feel like I had the skill to pursue it. So I kept drawing and painting. That's what I felt comfortable with. Roger Routson was my major professor at K-State. A lot of shaped canvases, a lot of work on paper, very much interested in the landscape and the colors of the landscape and the layering that you'll see within the Flint Hills. This brings me to graduate school. So in 1984, I went to the University of New Mexico and got my master's in 1986. This is Tim App, who was one of my major professors. He now teaches at Baltimore at the Maryland School of Art. Now we're into the 2000s, This is Marvin Gould, who was an instructor at K-State, just retired. He's back in the back, but fabulous, talented artist, and really influences me now. Okay, let's start with my work. Printmaking, lithography, this was a shop we had about 1982, drawn on stone, printed multiple times. I did not feel this was very successful, personally. That's why I got out of printmaking. So, you know, when you draw and print it, what happens is the drawing looks great, but maybe the print doesn't look so good. So why not continue drawing and just draw it? So that was my feeling. So, like I said, 1984, I got out of printmaking. This is, again, undergraduate school. So I think you can see some of the influences of my professors and other artists of the 20th century. So shape canvas, acrylic on canvas over a hard surface, hard edge painting. Again, the same time period. I'm not sure what I need to say about it other than very much influenced, again, by, I think, the Kansas landscape, the sky, the colors. The shape doesn't necessarily have to do with anything other than it's a three-dimensional painting. I mean, it's, you know, break it out of the square, break it out of the rectangle. Negative spaces are just as important as positive spaces. So what I'm trying to do is really combine all these elements of lines and shapes and colors and different tones into a very cohesive, cohesive piece of artwork. Drawing charcoal on paper. This would have been a few years after, probably 1984, when I was at New Mexico. A fairly large piece. And this is about as big as I ever got. It's maybe 4 feet by 40, maybe 40 by 60 inches, something like that. This is graduate school. This is a piece I did. Now look at those glasses. A piece I did for my thesis show. So very much related to like Ellsworth Kelly's shape canvases, but maybe more texture within the paint itself. It's probably hard to see. Again, the color's kind of washed out in the slide, but there's big fields of color. There are solid colors, and then the blue area kind of in the center is very much texturized. A little bit later, I got into making furniture. So, again, three-dimensional painting. These pieces are not very big. They're maybe smaller than a chair size. Not necessarily useful, but artistic. And trying to push the idea of paint in a more a different direction, or again, three-dimensional painting, but really making it object. This is a little bit later, homage to Mondrian series. So Mondrian did a lot of handmade frames. So the frame that's on this piece is handmade and painted to match the panels. That's all three-quarter, like birch plywood, acrylic, enamel with a varnish. And this is not very big. I brought a piece that was standing up here that's from that same series that people can look at, 12 by 12 inches. When I did my graduate show, I was working with a square canvas, and it was about 60 inches square, and then I shaped that to geometric shapes. After that exhibition, I decided I needed to work small because, first of all, you can't store that kind of work, and you can't ship it very well. It just gets damaged. So I started working small again. Another three-dimensional painting done about 1990, 91. I keep looking back just because I don't want to see what the color looks like when you see it up there. It's a little bit brighter in the slides on the computer. Again, very small wall piece. Many different planes to paint on. You paint on the edges as well as the front surfaces, the back surfaces. I only did a few of these. I don't know why, but just they took a long time. I just got into other things after that. So I kind of went back to drawing after I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And this is a little bit later, probably. And these are very small works on paper, maybe 4 inches by 4 inches. Again, landscape influence, but also they are what they are. Each shape, each color influences the next. It's important to work with the edges in my work. So when you look at these close, you see the tonalities change maybe throughout a shape, you know, from edge to edge. It creates more diverse color, more diverse texture. And most of these are drawn with colored pencil or pencil ink, a little bit of watercolor, a little bit of acrylic. They're very flat, you know, they're not texturized like some of the bigger canvases are. Even though I did that quite a bit, I may not, you know, there may not be that many images within these slides that show that. The Jasper Johns flag painting, you start seeing those stripes. I did this piece after my first wife passed away. You know, you kind of feel lost there for a while. And one thing that got me through was really working on my own artwork. And the wolf is a self-portrait kind of me, like I'm kind of out there in the entanglement, I guess, of life at that time. So one of the few pieces that are really like that are very self-referential, I think. I did another piece that I did that was kind of her. She was a wolf figure too, but she was passing the opposite direction than what this is, based on her passing away. let's see. I'm not sure. This would have been. I'm not sure of the date on this piece. I did this piece for a show in Topeka. Jasper's Puzzle. It was a theme of puzzles. Was the theme of the exhibition. Again, it's very small. It's maybe 4 inches by 10 inches, something like that. This one I did 2001 after the World Trade Center bombing. There was another exhibition in Topeka that was the theme was games, so I used the term head games, using the imagery of the World Trade Center bombing, you know, the buildings on fire. It just didn't make any sense to me, you know, why people would do that, you know. A little bit later, early 2000s, again, kind of all the similar imagery, textures. I think some of these I started out doing monoprinting, which is doing something off of like an acrylic plate where you paint on the plate and then put the paper on that, run it through a press. And what you get kind of is what you get. I mean, what I decided to do was, what I liked about that was the base underneath. So it's fairly transparent, I think. So I took that and I just reworked it. I did all those different compartmentalized areas, repainted stuff, ink, again, the same kind of material as I've been using. Similar drawing technique as before, but very much Kansas landscape influence on with these pieces. But all these are very small. All these square ones are probably 4 inches by 4 inches. This was a lithograph that I reworked and repainted over the top of. I set up a still life setup, and I did these lithographs. These were actually done in undergraduate school. And again, you know, if the print doesn't come out looking very good, what are you going to do with it? So just take it and rework it. Put a bunch of color over the top of it, redraw it. It's only about 4 inches by 6 inches. Same idea, working with all these different layers of information, lines, things intersecting, things going behind other things, you know, really trying to make that composition really deep looking within a very flat surface. Now I get into something different. The symbol series is, I'm not sure the year I started those, 2004 probably. And these are about 12 inches square, so I kind of went back to that square format. It works on paper. And so I took these cross bands and I embossed the paper, which means I ran it through a press. And then I just started drawing on them and painting on them. What I like about these images is that cross band structure is so powerful. To me, it just creates a great composition. So I did a whole bunch of these, and that's a takeoff on the same idea, but, you know, not making everything so perfectly linear and square. So I got into a lot of paint, a lot of layers of paint and ink and pencil. And some of the cross bands are not, like I said, I didn't want everything to be perfectly the same size, you know, perfectly square. they got kind of dark after a while. I started going with a lot of black because I was pretty depressed at that moment. Then it changed. This is a cat handmade paper. So for those of you who has ever seen handmade paper, very thick, and you make it from paper pulp. And so I kind of took that 12-inch square format, and I put these in a mold, and so they came out 12 by 12. And when they're wet, I embossed them again to get those cross bands. And also the pulp, you can add all kinds of stuff in there when you're making it. You could do it in a blender, or you could do it in a big tub or whatever. But I started adding paint and other things into the pulp. So you get all this beautiful colored paper. Same thing. Some of these were not photographed, but they were scanned. So I lost a little bit of the square just in the image, even though it's a square piece. Pretty much self-explanatory as far as having seen the rest of the pieces before and all those relationships. This is made out of denim fibers. I did this a number of years ago for a show at the Stricker Nelson Gallery, and I took a canvas that I had that I had never done anything with. It was just a blank canvas, but I'd saved it. And I took that and I just did a whole new painting, get back to my roots. There's a piece of cottonwood attached to that front of that piece. So again, it's the idea of three-dimensional painting, but actually adding some natural elements into it. I think I did this maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It's hanging at my brother's house. Oop. And that's what I do at the museum. My design work. So let me show a couple of those just to show you kind of what I do. Why I haven't worked so much in art, but this is what I do at the museum. Design shows. And it has its own elements that are really exciting to it. But it all relates. You know, it's all related together. So maybe you can see some kind of relationship between coloration and design with that, with what I've done with my own artwork. And this is the last project, which is totally different, but for those who haven't seen that, cairns on the beach, the stone cairns that Stan Hurd designed, and then we did these seed implantings around that. So again, there's a relationship there, and I think some of the geometric designs, natural elements. And this will go on for several years. Those are my slides. I don't know if there's time for questions.
Enjoyed. Thank you so much for sharing this wonderful work that you do. I've known you for so many years, and I had no idea. I've only seen one or two of your things. But I wanted to ask about the fact that many of your pieces don't really have names. Is there a reason behind that?
Some of them do, and I didn't show many of those. Most of the ones I showed are just numbers, like there'll be symbol series 21 or whatever. I don't think I think about that because you're always having to explain your titles to people, you know. Unless it's really overt, you know, like with the wolf images or something like that, that might be very self-referential. I prefer not to title them in any way that, I don't know how to explain it. It's just yeah, I guess that's the best way to put it. I mean, you know, I sign everything and I date everything, and a lot of them have, everything has a number or a title of some form, even if it's, you know, Kansas Landscape number 4. Okay. You know, so I think that there's some, yes, Mike.
I was had the privilege of being close to the originals here, and maybe I should have said something earlier. Almost all of the large concentrations of brown that you saw up there were blue. And so if you ever have a chance to see the originals, it'll be a different art show. worthy of your time and effort to see them, because they are very striking. I don't know how much, you know, don't know enough about why that projection comes out so different from what is in the original, but they are very, very striking with all that blue. You like blue, right?
I like everything.
Yeah, well.
you know, so one thing I didn't talk about much was why I do it. You know, obviously the spiritual and art is, you know, why you do it is because it does something to you, does something for you. It's the one thing in my life that I can do that is totally mine, you know? And that creativity, nobody can do what I do, and I can't do what anybody else does. So, you know, when I do it, I'm just in another world. I'm in another state of mind. And Michael asked me to do this presentation a while back, and I'm kind of nervous about that because I don't do much of this, you know. I've curated some shows where I've had to give talks, and I give talks at the museum sometimes, but I very rarely get to talk about my own work except one-on-one with somebody. And it really put me in a different frame of mind about really wanting to get back to work on my own artwork. I've been trying to do that for a number of years, and you know, it's a real impetus for me to do it.
Well, thank you for sharing with us, and I hadn't thought about it, but I really appreciate you putting yourself out here like this, and I hope that for in this venue with this audience that it feels like one-on-one. Felt like one-on-one to me.
Good.
My question was, you had two slides of shaped canvases that were butted up against one another. And in the second of the two, it seemed as though the multiple light sources illuminating it were creating shadows that continued the patterns and the relationships on the wall that they were hanging on. And I was just curious whether that was a happy accident or whether you designed the lighting that way intentionally.
I think it's both. I mean, you can wash that out if you add too much light to those. But certainly if you're going to do it from above and at a certain angle, what is important when you show those pieces is the shadows as well. Again, that becomes the negative-positive space idea. And those pieces are like an inch and a half off the wall. So, you know, it gives people an opportunity to really look around the edges of the piece. And yeah, the shadows are that's really important in those kind of works, what you get. I think it adds to the overall whatever, however you want to describe it.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, my question might be related to one of the same pieces. The one that was very three-dimensional made me wonder, at what point does it cease to be a painting and become a sculpture? Is that something that you think about in your work at all?
I probably wouldn't define it that way myself, because I don't consider myself a sculptor, but they're sculptural in their shapes and all that. But because I want to paint, and paint around the edges and everything's painted, even that stick in that one painting has a different kind of finish on it. It's three-dimensional painting in my view. That's the way I define it. So, the furniture I've done is still three-dimensional painting. Because they're not, I wouldn't consider them useful for furniture.
I know the appeal of applying your own thoughts to your own artwork. Now that you work at the museum and you're the one that helps coordinate all the showings, how does that transfer for you as far as when you're working the composition of your own work and then you're doing a composition of everyone else's work to a certain appeal or a certain topic, I guess?
Well, that's a good question. I guess working small like I do with my own work, and I can turn it any different direction and look at it and work at it from that way. I think one of the main differences between designing an exhibition at the museum, you're at an eye level view, pretty much. Now we've got high ceilings at the museum, so there are some shows where you're going to be having stuff way up high and hanging from the ceiling and that type of thing. And so that probably plays more into it, the way I design an artwork and the way I would design a show that's got all these different elements to it that are all over the whole space. But most of the exhibitions are like, you're looking at an eye level, there's a relationship there somewhere, but I don't know that I could define it for each exhibition.
Lindsay, Kristen Corwin, I'd also like to say thank you very much for this presentation. I've rarely seen so much competition for this microphone, so it's very
thank
popular.
You. I'm happy. Hopefully it was successful.
Oh, very much. At one point, you were showing several uniquely shaped canvases together. I think it's maybe one of the pieces we were talking about with the shadows. And I was just sure that this was a picture of outer space. I mean, I saw the colors, and then I saw a nebula. And then you said I was inspired by the Kansas landscape. And I thought, oh, it's totally different from what I thought it was. But that just increased my enjoyment of it. Now, possibly that's partly the distortion in the colors, but how do you feel when people take something you've made and turn it into something completely different in their heads? Is that a good thing?
Oh, I have no control over that. I mean, that doesn't bother me one bit. So, the good thing about abstraction is, as Dick said, you get all these opinions about what that image might be. Everybody has to bring their own thoughts to it, And once it leaves my hands, it's out of my control. So,
Diane Barker, and that's a perfect segue into my question, because you were working with the cross and the four quadrants then that creates. I wondered if the number four or that geometric power had any spiritual significance for you.
It probably did, but I don't know if I recognized it at the time. I'm not sure what I can say about it. It's nice when people see stuff like that and make those associations. I use that term in defense of geometry, but it has really very little to do about math, you know, seeing these images. Other than, well, the number four probably has some significance, because there seems to be a lot of pieces that have a 4-inch, you know, 4-inch by 4-inch or 4-inch by 6-inch, or maybe it's just the rationale of how that works together geometrically. Everything inside of it works with everything that's outside of it. So I haven't talked to math professors very much about it, and I'm sure they'd have some interesting thoughts if they saw it.
Alex Stenson, so you titled it In Defense of Geometry, right? You're defending it. It's actively, and you don't defend things unless you feel passionate or kind of invested in the concept, right? So what's like driving that passion or kind of investment in the idea of geometry or geometric expression, right? Because that's kind of what you're doing, is using shapes and, you know, reshaping and expressing in that way. So.
Yeah, I mean, geometric shapes are geometric shapes. I mean, right. You know, they're there.
I guess, what do you find compelling about them? What pulls, makes that worth defending?
Well, going back to what all the artists I studied and how passionate they were about it, and just taking all those ideas and just, you know, breaking them apart and reforming it all together into their own ideas. Yeah, it's worth defending because it's what I do. It's what I study. It's what I like. So I don't want people to discount it as being not good art, okay? I think it's great, you know. You got to realize almost all these artists, including myself, you start out being a realist, you know, and then you learn what you can do and what you can't do, and where to take it. I mean, that's what you study. You learn how to draw from a still life, or you learn how to draw a vase of flowers, and then you take it from there, and you find what your passion is, and this is what mine is with my own artwork. I mean, it's what I feel comfortable with. You know, what can I do with all those shapes? What can I do with all those colors? And does it make me feel happy? You know, well, not all the images are successful. I mean, I throw away as much as I keep. But the good thing is I'll do another one, you know? So just like baking bread or something, I guess, you know?
Kathleen says this is got to be the last comment. I got to say, looking at the fourness and so forth, you had a series of horizontal and vertical images, horizontal and vertical images, horizontal and vertical images. And I felt such relief when you then had something sort of at an angle with the triangle. So speaking as a semi-mathematical professor here, I got to tell you, I appreciate symmetry, but I really like it when it's broken a little bit.
I agree. It can't all be the same.
That your presentation has inspired you to do more artwork in the near future. So,
yeah, thanks, Dick. Yeah, it has.
Good. Okay, we're going.